Audible Originals presents Kismet, written by Lauren Blakely, performed by Julia Whalen and Shane East.
His prologue. A little while ago. Ivy crawls up the battered wall, skating between seams, gliding along the old stones, until it wraps its green arms around a cracked window pane, as if embracing the window. Or perhaps silently strangling it. Ivy on a secret mission. That's what I'll call this shot. I lift my camera and snap a pic, then another of a sneaky vine hell-bent on covering the corner of this tiny old church, tucked into an alley several streets away from St. Paul's Cathedral. There, crowds snake around the famous site, waiting for its doors to open. Here, there's only me at dawn, like an intrepid modern-day explorer, stumbling upon a hidden gem in London. I'll plant a flag and mark my discovery. Right, sure. Like that's my style. My soft laugh lands lightly in the eerie early morning quiet. The city has barely stretched its arms and drunk its tea. Bet this ivy becomes famous any day now, I murmur. It's an offhand remark, the kind I'd make while sharing the photo over lunch. Want to lay odds on when this spot will be overrun by Instagrammers? We'd place our bets, I imagine, make predictions, then exchange stories of the day. It's a possibility for a future, but an unlikely one. I dismiss the make-believe afternoon scene and take a few steps back from the church to frame another shot. Another angle. Another perspective. I click off a few more, then I lower the camera and drink in the view alone. Letting go of the fleeting wish that I could share it with someone. There are plenty of other things to do than share. Pictures to take, books to read, and work to do. It's time to go.
Her prologue. 10 years ago. I can't wait. With bated breath, I turn the key in the lock of my studio apartment. Fine. Studio is a generous term. Closet is more like it. But hey, it's New York and it's mine. I exhale, still over the moon that I'm here, still thrilled about this place I found online. Despite the ear-piercing squawk from the door as I push it open. Whoa, that squeal is like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. But I'll snag some WD-40, give the hinges a tune-up. Just like all lavish love on my brand new place. Plants, flowers, posters, the whole nine yards. I step inside for the first time. Huh. It's smaller than the pics on the website. Stretching out an arm, I can almost touch the other wall. The one with the drawing of a window on it. Yep. The only window in my basement studio is the one painted on the wall. I drag a deep inhale of sauerkraut. My new matchbox of an apartment smells like a hot dog cart. And what's that hanging from the ceiling? As I wave a hand in front of my face, something sticks to my fingers. No. Just no. Spiderwebs. There are spiderwebs in my sardine can home. I shudder. Spiders and I don't get along. But that's okay, I reassure my racing heart. No big deal. I'm in Manhattan. Spiders are nothing. Food smells are a fact of life. Besides, I have my own bathroom. I turn 90 degrees, and there it is. Literally the size of me. Yes, I have a gym locker of a bathroom. But it's all good. I can handle this because the great big this of New York City has always been my goal after studying for my master's on the West Coast. I plan to embrace every single second in the city of dreams. I'm like the starlet in a movie musical, fresh off the bus, singing and twirling in her flouncy skirt, ready to tap dance down the Great White Way and show the Broadway director what she can do. Okay, I don't sing, dance, or act, but I do know art history, from the caves of Lascaux to Warhol's Campbell's soup cans and back. Nothing will stop me from owning the New York art world. Not my past, not the tangled web of lies woven through the last few years, and not the people who deceived me. They're out of my orbit now, and I plan to make my life my own. New home, new city, new friends. This is me starting over. I remember what Mom told me before I left for college. You've got this. I so do. Goodbye, past. Hello, present. 10 fast, fantastic years later, I've moved out of that first windowless, condiment-scented coffin and into a one-bedroom on the Upper West Side. Bonuses include a window, the smell of lilacs, and the blissful absence of 8-legged creepy crawlies. I've worked my way up to a better job, and I'm making more moolah and loving life in my favorite place on earth, this city. I have oodles of friends, loads of inspiration, and a ton of found family. After years of feeling a little bit lost, New York is now my home. I'm ready for whatever's around the corner. Ideally, it might include a 4-letter word like gasp, love. Then, one morning, I walk into my office and I learn that the real dirty word is next.
Chapter 1. Heath. I've become resigned to the meager offerings on the new release shelf in my neighborhood bookshop, disappointed by both the number and content. I pick up today's featured contender, a photo book of the most social media ready spots in all of London, compiled by, let's see, a quartet of Instagrammers. Great. I scoff as I flip through the pages. It's like every top 5 London list ever. Big Ben, the Tower of London, Tower Bridge, blah, blah, blah. So many unique views in this city, and not one of them included. Missed this great spot. Missed that great spot. I snap the book closed in disgust. Something displeases you, Heath. The question comes from Nigel, the shopkeeper. I glance his way and see that he hasn't even looked up from the counter. About this? I hold up the offending book. That'd be... wait for it. Just about everything. Then you should grab the green book next to it. It has you written all over it. I give him a side eye, but it's wasted. Nigel's attention doesn't stray from his tablet. I step closer to the counter so I can see the screen, where he swipes at numbers in boxes on the screen. Can't you have the decency to do Sudoku with an actual pencil? And, say, on paper? Like, in a book? With pages? Nigel shakes his shaved head. Not a speck of hair covers his gleaming skull. Nope. I harumph and turn back to the shelf, then recoil when I spot a mint green paperback the size of a deck of cards. And the author is... The Wit and Wisdom of Twitter. Seriously? You're peddling this tripe? It's not really a book. It's a collection of inspirational quotes curated from a social media feed. I bet it has pictures of sunsets and teacups with steam rolling off them, and twinkling chili pepper lights strategically hung on doorways. At last, Nigel raises his face. He flashes me a toothy grin, pearly white against his dark skin. And it sells like half-off tickets to a strip club in Leicester Square. I don't have to open it to know I'm right, but I do. Shaking my head as I ingest the bland banalities. Follow your dreams. Today is a gift. Embrace the future. Books are for stories. Any kind of story. Adventure, romance, mystery, horror, or for useful information. But this is just regurgitated musings on taking a bath at the end of the day, or drinking wine when coffee won't do the trick. I could find all of this insight on the internet like that, I say, snapping my fingers and reshelving the excuse for a book. Nigel's eyes widen in exaggerated surprise. You know how to use the internet. Miracles abound every day. It's that thing where you type in any question, right? Like, Why is everyone an asshole today? Now that would be a good book. He scratches his jaw. Come to think of it, I'm pretty sure we've got that very title right behind the new biographies. And I'm pretty sure he's taking the piss out of me. Is that so? Yes, behind the bio of that reality show socialite. He snaps his fingers as if to jog his memory. The one who had a boob job, or... wait, was it ass implants? Something got bigger, something got smaller. Someone was sued, someone's a twat. Take a look behind it. You'll find the book you're looking for. I fold my arms and stare him down. Why not just tell me what's at the end of this scavenger hunt? Finally, Nigel clears his throat and returns his attention to his puzzle, giving in and muttering. There's a new Trevor Masters. It's fantastic. You'll find it tucked behind the bio, you fucking prick. Oh, that is indeed the one I want. I move the torrid tell-all aside. Nothing wrong with tell-alls, but it's not what I came for. My grin broadens with satisfaction when I find the prize. I knew you were holding on to something good. Admit it, you tucked this nugget away just for me. He scoffs. I did nothing of the sort. I saw it there and couldn't be bothered to move it. Oh, it just hit there by itself, did it? I grab the new murder mystery and scan the jacket copy. A body turns up dead on a fishing boat, complete with a lure in the mouth. The detective smells foul play. But does it have everything I like in it? Nigel looks up, strokes his beard. Let's see. Loads of red herrings, bone-chilling suspense, a messy on-page murder with tons of blood. I'd say there's all your favorite things, Heath. I thumb the cover decisively. Excellent. I tuck the book under my arm and head to the counter. And let me know when you get the Rhys Locke in paperback, too. I've avoided all spoilers on his last jewel heist mission for a year. Your talent for avoidance knows no bounds, he remarks. I could win a medal. As he rings me up, I glance around the shop at the displays. Once upon a time, Nigel carried only books. Now his little shop teems with cards, stickers, and coasters boasting ironic sayings such as, I like you, I'll kill you last, and wine, because people suck. If memory serves, you used to sell books here, right? There's a pair of socks hanging near the till, with an illustration of a young girl hugging a horse and the caption, I hate everyone too. Nigel's eyes flicker with excitement. Decided I rather like paying the bills, and these days everyone loves cheeky sayings more than books. I finger the socks. How many pairs of I hate everyone socks do you sell? His grin reeks of money. Dozens. It's the thing. People hate everything now, and they love telling each other so. Slap up a saying about how much you hate something, and you're gold. I'm hunting around in my wallet for some bills, and Nigel flicks a finger at my phone. You could put your credit card on your phone, you know. Then you could tap it against the card reader. He nods to a black space-age device on the counter. Makes it a lot easier for people like me. Shuddering, I shoot him a you've-gone-mad look. Why would I want to do that? Make life easy for you? He shrugs, shaking his head. Don't know. Maybe fitting in with society and all that. Ah, you mistook me then for someone who wants to be a part of things, I tell him. Then you surely understand the market for these socks, he says. With a grin, I tuck the book in my canvas bag and head toward work, with a quick stop along the way. Around the corner from the bookshop, I dart up the steps into the local library for a drop-off.
Better have something good this time,
Alice calls from behind the counter, where she's sorting returns. I only bring you the finest hardcovers and paperbacks. I reach into my bag and grab the stack of books I've already read. These all come with the Heath Graham seal of approval.
Someday I'm going to turn that into a book club, make you the next Oprah or Rhys. For now, I'm just glad these are mine.
Flicking her long braid behind her shoulder, She bends over to check the titles one by one.
Ooh, I have a waiting list for the Rees-Lock,
she says, then pats the top of the stack.
I appreciate them all,
she winks.
And I won't tell a soul you donate all your darlings.
Thank you for keeping my secrets, I say. Then I'm on my way. The next day, I still have no clue who killed the fisherman. At a cafe near the office, I flip another page, finishing my tea as I race through the whodunit. A quick glance at my watch tells me I can squeeze in one more chapter before my first phone meeting at the auction house where I work. Normally, I'd head to the office and make sure I was there with 5 minutes to spare, but today's different. Today, I desperately need the distraction of murder. I focus on the story in front of me. The killer could be the bait supplier, the boat owner, or possibly the sea captain. It could be someone I haven't considered yet. Intrigue has me racing through the pages. Then a high-pitched voice slices through my concentration.
Oh my God, I never saw that ending coming. I can't believe it was actually the captain's wife who did it.
What? No.
Oh no, she didn't.
In slow motion, one painful millimeter at a time, I raise my gaze from the book in my hands. A young blonde, maybe in college, notices me, starts to smile, then spots what I'm reading and gasps. Her hand flies to her mouth, then waves about like she can erase what she said.
Nope, I'm wrong.
She smacks the side of her head.
Dumb, Sandy. That's not what happened. I'm thinking of the first book in that series. Yes, that's it.
But it's too late. She popped the balloon of my reading pleasure. At least she stops trying to fix the unfixable. I heave a sigh as the girl walks off. Why do I even bother to read here, in a place where people feel compelled to talk? Oh, right. Because reading is one of the few things I unequivocally love. Reading outside, reading inside, reading before work, reading after work. One of the most solitary, simple joys is reading anywhere, and today I need all the joyful I can get. I finish my tea, pay and thank the waiter, then tuck the pointless book under my arm. The captain's wife. It figures. I head along the pavement, making my way to the building where I work. Stepping into the lift, I wince. Sandy's here, and she's grinning.
It wasn't her,
she says, backpedaling.
I was totally thinking of this Rees-Lock book, the one that came out last week, where it turns out the jewels were in the hot air balloon.
Wait. She backpedaled into another spoiler.
Stop. Just stop.
I hold up a hand. Want to let me know how the next season of You sorts out? I hear my brother's voice. Be nice every now and then, it wouldn't hurt you. But his rebuke isn't loud enough to stop me. Maybe whether they killed off the latest doctor, or could you perhaps just stop talking to me and cease ruining my day? Sandy's lower lip trembles.
I'm sorry.
Seconds later, tears well in her eyes. My heart lurches. Oh, I'm such a sucker for tears, especially when I've been the asshole who caused them. But before I can reach into my pocket for a tissue, the lift stops on the sixth floor, the doors part, and she bolts like her feet are on fire. I exit the lift more slowly, grumble a hello to the red-haired receptionist at Highsmith Associates, weave through the cubes to my office door. Inside, I sling my jacket on the chair, and roll up my sleeves as I reach my desk. I toggle on the computer. Despite my current mood, the phone meeting goes well, and I enjoy 9 blessedly silent minutes while I review a report from the valuations department. Then the goateed, bespectacled marketing manager pops in.
Need any help with your reports, Heath?
I don't bother to take off my reading glasses. Nope, Freddy, I'm all good. Freddy tugs at his bow tie, decorated with yellow ducks.
Well, then, want to help me brainstorm a marketing tagline for the new Expressionism collection? We could grab a pint after work at the Magpie and have a chat. My wife could join us when we're done.
Now I do remove the glasses, sensing this is leading somewhere. Freddy clears his throat and goes on. Millie has a lovely friend she wants to introduce to you. Name is Livy and she's a teacher. Ah, the plot thickens. It's a setup, and not even a veiled one at that. A few years back, I would have said yes to this sort of thing. I tried. Truly, I made the effort. I met the Livies of the world, the friends of a friend, the cousins of a friend, even the tennis coaches. Those blind dates never worked for reasons. There are some things in life where if at first you don't succeed, you try again. But blind dating is not one of them. I don't need to explain to Freddy that I've been there, done that, and bought the t-shirt. It's personal, private. It's not about art or valuations or collections or any of the reasons why I sit at this desk each day. Neither do I need to remind me yet again of why I'm saying no. Instead, I nod like I'm considering his offer. Let me have a think on that. Great! See you later, mate. No, you won't. Once he leaves, I call several clients, reviewing upcoming works, confirming details. As I hang up after the last one, Rhea, one of the sales specialists, pops into the doorway, fidgeting with her chunky gold bracelet.
Hi, Heath. I have to do a presentation for Emily tomorrow on how to best position emerging artists, and I would love some notes. Any chance you can feedback me as I practice?
Is feedback a verb now? A rhetorical question. I'm fairly certain that's not how grammar works.
If not, it should be. I love being feedbacked. I can feedback you anytime you want to collab.
My stomach curdles at that truncated word. How much precious time does lopping off a few syllables save, really? Iterate, collab, feedback, deep dive. They're all the worst. How shall I dodge her request? I choose the speediest route. Best way to position emerging artists is alongside established ones. That'll help you reach new and seasoned collectors, Rhea. So pair them one for one.
Great! Oh, yes, that's brilliant. Cheers.
She ducks away, but rather than leaving, she pops in once more.
Do you like darts? Bunch of us here have a darts night at the pub around the corner, and some of my friends are coming too, if you want to join.
Ah, so it's not just darts. It's never just darts. It's the start of another Heath project. I'm afraid I'm busy then, I say. Her brow furrows and she ums uncertainly.
But I didn't give you the date.
Bollocks. Normally I stay a step ahead when evading social requests. That captain's wife spoiler must have knocked my avoidance radar far off kilter. Best to recalibrate a smidge. Oh, didn't you? My mistake. Maybe send it via email then. I flash her a grin and make a mental note. Do not open emails from Rhea. Once she's gone, I spin back to my computer and click open my agenda for an upcoming private sale of some postmodern works. I'm ahead of schedule on it and should be able to turn it in early to Emily, keeping up my streak of handing in projects ahead of time. No one even comes close to my record. This hare's pace gives me just enough time to peruse job openings here at Highsmith. Maybe there's a work-from-home post somewhere within the company. I would have fewer distractions, could run more auctions, launch more sales, see less people. That would be bliss. Work remotely are the two sexiest words in the English language. I'm about to click on a job link when my phone trills. I answer and hear,
Heath, it's Emily. Can you come to my office straight away?
Her tone brooks no argument. I say yes to the boss, then head to her corner suite, curious why she's calling out of the blue. When I walk into the office, I stop in my tracks. Sandy, the spoil-anything blonde, is perched on the edge of Emily's couch. She clutches a book. Looks like the title is There's No I in Teamwork. I never judge anyone's reading choices. Photo books do not count. They are not free from the arrows of my side eye. So I'm not casting aspersions on this self-help workplace improvement book. But the title does make my spine tingle with concern.
Heath, I understand you've met my niece. Sandy's in London from Leeds, where she's been studying psychology of the workplace at university.
Emily begins, then takes a beat to remove her gold-rimmed glasses, folding them and setting them neatly on her desk.
And we thought perhaps you might need...
She lifts her thumb and forefinger to show a sliver of space.
More teamwork. More collab. It's the new way of working. So while Sandy's here as an intern at Highsmith for the next month or so, she's going to help me out. She and I will brainstorm on projects where you can team up with others. There'll be some group projects and then a bit of one-on-one work, perhaps with Freddie or maybe Rhea. I'll let you know when we've decided.
Kill me now. That sounds utterly fantastic. I managed to force the words past the vinegar in my throat. I am now in utter sympathy with the pair of socks from Nigel's shop. When I return to my office, my goal is singular: find a new job. I bring up the opening Emily posted earlier in the week and study it. Yes, this one would be a great feather in my cap, a fabulous string to my bow. And, best of all, it would mean I could work remotely. Alone. Just like I've been since my wife died, 4 years ago today.
Chapter 2. Joe. I have a talent for knowing when something fabulous is going to happen. And there's an energy when I wake on Friday morning, a certain crackle in the air. I throw off the covers, stretch my arms, and open the window. Cue the sunshine streaming in, the birds chirping. I blast an upbeat Broadway number as I go through my morning, dancing in my obscenely spacious New York apartment, one wall painted robin's egg blue, another the color of mint. I brew the world's best cup of coffee as I sing along to the chorus. Okay, fine. I live in a one-bedroom, not an obscenely large rom-com New York apartment, and if I open the living room window, the only bird flying in would be a pigeon. But I have a window, and that never grows old. Still, I like to imagine I live in one of those impossible New York pads that magazine editors can magically afford on the silver screen. I'm the plucky young New Yorker, ready to tackle the big, brave world. Fine. I'm 32 and hardly young or plucky. But I have a young soul and an active imagination. After a quick shower, I get dressed for a huge day at work. 20 minutes later, I've applied my best professional eyeliner and mascara, buttoned up a cute blue blouse, and slid on a pair of Mary Janes covered with daisies in yellow and teal. They're good luck shoes. I'm armed and ready for the big day. I head out, making my way down Columbus Avenue with the soundtrack to Anything Goes chirping in my AirPods. All days are better when they begin with a Cole Porter number. I swing past Dr. Insomnia's Tea and Coffee Emporium, shielding my eyes from the morning sun as I peer in the window. Easton looks ready to hold court at a table in the back. That's my cousin. I'm pretty sure he has a patent on unshakable confidence. After I turn off the tunes, I yank open the door and march over to his throne. "Aren't you just looking like the king of the world today?" I say to the guy who's my biggest champion. Easton shoots me an easy grin, his smile casual and cool and lighting up his blue eyes, the same color as mine. We have a lot of sames, even for being cousins. Same shade of dark brown hair, same fair skin. Plus, we scored epic long lashes courtesy of our respective moms, who are sisters. Funny how you never think long lashes are something that work on a guy, but it's a little scary how much the ladies dig Easton's eyelashes. Or at least, that's what I've heard from his girlfriend, Bellamy. Sliding a small jar of yogurt my way, he says, "Here you go. With blueberries. Figured you'd already had your daily allotment of coffee at home." I waggle a finger approvingly at him. "Just like I tell my girlfriends, you're a goddess. And you should take that as high praise. It's a rare guy who attains goddess status." He shoots me a dubious look, but shrugs lightly. "I'll take the compliment. But how hard is it to remember you only drink one cup of coffee a day and you prefer yogurt for breakfast?
I guess it's not too hard. It's easy to see I only need one coffee. I'm naturally caffeinated beyond that, I say with a playful bob of my shoulder.
You're the peppiest, he deadpans.
I stretch an arm across the table to poke him. Nothing wrong with peppy. Besides, peppy is good for my career. I've been racing up the corporate ladder at my company since I joined it 365 days ago, something my dad never believed I could do. But that's my father for you, always warning me about the pitfalls of my career. Are you ready to take that on? Is that a little out of your league? You sure you can handle that? Oh yes, Pops, I am so sure. I've handled it all, thank you very much. And now I'm going to make my pitch for the VP post at Bancroft House, I tell Easton. He sweeps his arm majestically, granting me an audience.
Practice on me. That is how you'll become the youngest person ever to hold VP status there.
Indeed it is, I say.
And a rehearsal in front of the best will help you get there.
I give him an I'm-so-touched grin. Aw, I love your humility.
It is indeed endless, he says. Proceed.
I've been practicing my pitch for days. I have it down pat, but I could use one more go. I square my shoulders and dive in. I'm ready to oversee the modern art department, I say. Then I give him my speech. I give him my speech as I've rehearsed it, stating my case with logic and positivity. And that's why I'm the best candidate for the job. Easton has a few tips. Slow down and don't race through my accomplishments. Mention my visions for the collection, but don't go into too much detail. I go through it one more time, taking his advice. When I'm done, my business-savvy cousin slow claps.
You're ready. Now go get him, Tiger.
30 minutes later, I march into work, head straight for Miranda's office, and make one hell of a case for why I'll serve this company well as the newest VP. We're an exciting new auction house that's been winning business left and right from the bigger, older, more established ones. This promotion will be the cherry on top of my fabulous New York life, the one I've crafted over a decade on my own, with no help from my father. And that's fine by me. That's why New York is so precious to me. I love this city with all its flaws and craziness. Manhattan and I are tight. Not a weekend goes by when I don't partake of a museum, a show, a pop-up shop, a new art installment, a pickleball bar, or a karaoke club. I imbibe this city, and it gives me joy, in no small part thanks to the people in my life. Men come and go, do they ever, but friends stay. I have a great crew sprinkled around the city. They're my rocks, and I've cobbled them together from a patchwork quilt of the best people. This new VP post will tie me more tightly to the place I love. Holding my breath, I prep for good news, hoping it comes my way. Miranda Bancroft flashes me her peach lipsticked grin.
You make an excellent case, Josephine, she says, and I want to kiss the sky.
I'm this close to VP. Surely Miranda's going to tell me about my raise and new business cards and the first auction I'll run in my new job. I mean, there she is, sitting tall, tucking her red hair behind her ears, her smile bursting.
There's only one little thing, she adds, like it's a treat she's about to offer.
That's promising. Maybe I can even start with the upcoming summer evening exhibition, just to convince her I'm her gal.
Sure. What is it?
I ask. Ready for anything at all. Bring it on. Miranda's smile widens.
As you may be aware, our elite little auction house has been growing so quickly and winning so much business that the older ones have sat up and taken notice.
Right, of course. Earlier this month, we beat out Christie's, Sotheby's, and Highsmith for the Abernathy collection, I say. That was quite a coup. Winning the chance to run the auction for one of Europe's most celebrated art collectors. Miranda runs a finger over her pearls, her reward for that successful auction.
Ah, yes. That one made me quite happy. So happy, in fact, that when Highsmith came calling with an offer too good to refuse, I didn't refuse it. My brow knits as I try to solve her riddle. What sort of offer? Highsmith is buying Bancroft. Oh, I say. That wasn't what I expected to hear today, or tomorrow, or any day. It's a great offer, Miranda goes on. And the best part is, Highsmith wanted to know who they should keep on, my top employees. I said you, of course. Despite the glow of pride that inspires, I'm dying to know what the heck it means. Thank you. I appreciate the vote of confidence. You deserve it, but here's the thing. Highsmith wants to keep you, but they'll be relocating your current job, she says, like she's handing me the keys to the Met. If you'd like to stay on, we'll be sending you to London. And in a month, you can make your pitch to Emily Hathaway, the department head there. London? Did she say London? The air goes still. My muscles tighten. My throat constricts. Memories of the last time I was in that city rush painfully into the present. The summer I spent there studying. The things that went down. The backstabbing secrets. The betrayal. London? I ask weakly, making sure I heard her correctly. She seems delighted for me, as if she can't imagine I wouldn't want to up and move to another country. Yes. It's fabulous there, isn't it? If you want to keep your current job, we need you to start in a week. And I'm confident the pitch you just made will be a terrific one across the pond, too. I slap on a smile that's fully fake. I don't really dislike anything. I'm not that kind of gal. But if there's one thing I hate, it's bloody fucking London. The next morning, Emerson announces she's coming to the rescue with cinnamon rolls. Emerson, they make everything a little better, I promise. See you soon. 30 minutes later, I swing open the door with a beleaguered sigh. With her chestnut hair bouncing in a high ponytail, my friend walks in, a purple box balanced on one hand, her purse and messenger bag on her shoulder. I'm here to save the day. With breakfast? She gives me a dull look. Breakfast is a very important way to reorganize all the dread in your life. Plus, I rounded up some strays. She nods behind her, then lowers her voice to a conspiratorial whisper. One of them is related to you, but we'll still consider him a friend. Thanks, Em, for the heartfelt endorsement. Easton deadpans as he appears in the hall behind her. You're welcome. She sweeps into my apartment, along with my cousin and more of our crew. Just so you know, London isn't that far, TJ says, straight to the point as usual. He drops a friendly kiss onto my cheek, his bearded jaw scratchy and familiar. I'll miss his scratchy hellos, his wise words, even though he's wrong. It's like living on Mars. Nolan plays the caboose, coming in last, and gives my shoulder a squeeze.
Look on the bright side. The food's better in London than on Mars.
I pretend to gag. That's not saying much. With slumped shoulders, I head to my purple couch and flop down. Everyone joins me in the living room. Easton hands me a coffee before he settles into a red chair.
Just the way you like it, Miss Perky, he says.
I groan, but clutch the cup like it's the Holy Grail. I'm already missing coffee. The coffee is awful in London. I don't think London can be all bad, Emerson says, flipping open the box of baked goodies. London is awful, and you know why, I say. I do, Emerson says sympathetically. Poppy and everything. A shudder rolls down my spine at the name of the woman who was once like a sister to me, something this only child desperately craved in my early 20s, something I needed terribly given the way my world fell apart during my master's program. It's been so long, though. So many years ago.
Will you have to see her?
TJ asks, his tone careful. I grit my teeth like I'm girding for battle.
Good question.
Or him, Emerson adds.
Equally good question.
I draw a deep, fueling breath, resetting, letting the memory of those two go.
Let's talk about something else. Anything else.
I wave toward the purple box, licking my lips at the sight of the cinnamon rolls.
Like Emerson's booty.
It is a nice one,
Nolan says dryly, giving Emerson's backside a lascivious look. I thump him on the shoulder.
Booty as in plunder, food plunder, baked goods.
Prizes, riches, loot,
TJ puts in, then adds,
at least that's how I sometimes use the word.
Word snobs,
Nolan accuses.
I know how to use the dictionary too.
But do you ever?
Easton counters, deadpan. I laugh, loving these guys and their zings. Taking a sip of the good brew my cousin brought, I peer inside the box, shoving aside all this talk of Poppy and him. The sight of pipsqueak-sized baked goods enchants me.
Are those the world's tiniest and tastiest cinnamon rolls?
Easton shoots Emerson a glare.
You need a microscope for these. Your texts promised cinnamon rolls, not a science experiment.
TJ clears his throat.
Sometimes size does matter, Em.
Nolan chuckles, but glances away like he's trying to hide something. I arch a brow, meeting Emerson's gaze, trying to read the meaning behind Nolan's private laugh, his booty comment. But her green eyes give nothing away.
They're delicious. Don't be sizist, TJ.
Plus, they're fuel. We're going to help JoJo pack and prep this place to sublease. TJ reaches into the box, grabs a roll.
Good point. All packing must be preceded by a moment of sweet supplication when the host presents her friends with treats in a blatant attempt at packing bribery.
I laugh, even as my heart squeezes.
See? I'll miss that too.
Easton scoffs dryly, pointing a thumb at TJ.
This guy?
I'm highly missable, TJ counters, then pops the cinnamon roll into his mouth.
You all are, I say with a helpless shrug.
I grab a roll to sop up the river of emotions rising in me. Easton clears his throat.
Listen, you're only moving, JoJo. You're only going to be a 7-hour flight away.
To the outsider, I probably sound like a privileged bitch complaining about moving to one of the most famous cities on Earth, a place that tons of people would beg, borrow, or steal to visit just once. But for me, London is lies and secrets. New York is truth and honesty. And home. It's not the distance, I add. It's just that, well, I'm going to miss you all so much. Emerson frowns with sympathy as she wraps an arm around me.
I'm going to miss you too.
Like so much I have to pretend that you're not going to get through the days. My heart glows a little from all the mutual missing and love.
Exactly. Who will see Wicked with me for the 9th time?
I'll go to London for Wicked, Emerson offers.
I will not, TJ declares. Just putting that out there. Not a musical fan. At all. But I definitely go to London for other reasons.
He wiggles a brow, a salacious glint in his brown eyes.
Yes, yes, King TJ, I know you love British accents, I say.
My romance writer friend nudges me with his elbow.
Bet you'll love the accents too. Pretty hard to resist.
He's not wrong. Even if a city holds unpleasant memories, I do like a British accent. Always have, ever since I was a young girl.
I mean, Mr. Darcy and Robin Hood.
Hard to go wrong, I add, owning it. But will we still talk? Emerson lifts a cinnamon roll in solidarity.
Yes, we absolutely will.
Nolan thrusts an arm skyward, classic superhero style.
From New York to London in a single FaceTime connection.
People say that, but do they do that?
TJ waves an arm.
Hello? I can write. It's literally what I do.
I shoot him a dubious look. I'm sure after penning hot, racy scenes all day, you want to write, "Hey, how are you?" emails at night.
The scenes aren't all hot and racy, he points out. Some are romantic and heartfelt. Many are banter-driven. Some are really fucking funny.
I pat TJ's shoulder. I read your books. Don't forget, I'm your biggest fan. Easton clears his throat.
I read Come Again. Clearly, I inspired TJ. I felt like it was written about me.
TJ rolls his big brown eyes.
And if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you.
Nolan jumps in.
Does the bridge come with fries?
Nolan, don't you know? Nearly everything good does, Emerson says to her co-host, a little flirt in her tone. I file that sound away so I can ask her more about it privately.
Words to live by, Nolan says.
He turns to me and counts his fingers as he rattles off,
FaceTime, Google Duo, Skype. It's going to be easy.
Don't forget Zoom. We can even do a Zoom watch party to finish the final episodes if that's what she said, Emerson points out. That brings a small smile to my face. I'm dying to know how it ends. I hope they stay together. If Webflix breaks up my favorite fictional couple, I will protest. We've watched this show together all season, sometimes on Zoom and sometimes in person. See? We already have plans for a watch party, Emerson says, cajoling me. And she's right. There is that. Easton sips his coffee, going thoughtful.
I think we keep in touch with the people we really want to stay in touch with, no matter how hard it is. You can't just kick me out of your life.
TJ offers a sympathetic smile, too, as he reaches for a cinnamon roll.
I'm not very easy to get rid of. Ex-boyfriends might say otherwise, but everyone else would pretty much agree.
Nolan nods, straight-faced.
He's pretty much a barnacle. I have barnacle tendencies, too, he adds dryly.
I wiggle my arm. Barnacle here as well. And hey, maybe it'll just be a short stint. Maybe it'll be like a year. I'll try to come back as often as I can. Even as I say it, though, I question my own words. Will I? I'm obsessed with my job. Dating has fallen by the wayside. My forays into the world of apps feel like ancient history. I didn't meet anyone who floated my boat or rocked my bed. Truthfully, I haven't since grad school, since Jacob. Sure, I've dated, had a few short-term boyfriends, but no one I fell for like that. No one who made me want to change my life. No one who hurt me that badly either. But I'd like to meet someone. I absolutely want to meet a fantastic man. Someone who likes the same things I do, who has the same dreams, who's warm and witty and outgoing. A people person. Like me. That's my dream guy. Just don't sublease my place to somebody you're going to like better than me. I add a laugh, but it comes out like a sob. Impossible, Emerson says, and everyone else chimes in too. We switch gears to the practical, finishing the coffee and cinnamon rolls, then turning to the hard work of packing. When I head to my bedroom to sort clothes, TJ and Emerson follow. We have some gifts for you, Emerson says. She hands me a book of the most photogenic spots in London, curated by top Instagrammers. I arch a brow at her choice. Are you trying to get me to fall for the city? Emerson shrugs, like she's saying, we know you so well. It's just places to check out when you decide to explore.
Take pics for us, TJ adds. You know, so we don't forget your face.
I stare at him. You'll get a ton of shots for that remark. Excellent, he says. I hug the book to my chest, grateful for the gift. I will. TJ goes next, offering me a paperback with a strapping stud on the cover, my favorite kind.
It's an advance copy of Hazel Valentine's new book. I know you love her.
I beam, giddy at the chance to gobble up her story before anyone else. Almost as much as your books.
Keep that praise coming, girlfriend. And listen, we have a plan for you.
His baritone voice always feels like a warm hug, especially now, but also when he's being sarcastic, which is 99% of the time. Emerson tips her head his way. It's his idea. TJ deals her a sharp stare.
You didn't have any issues when I first mentioned it to you.
Fine, fine, Emerson concedes. I approve of this plan, too. I park my hands on my hips. What is it, then? TJ's eyes gleam with mischief.
You know what you really need in order to embrace London?
I'm dying for the answer. Tell me, tell me. TJ draws a deep breath.
A red-hot, one-night stand the night you get there.
Emerson raises a finger to make a point. Or the second. She might be jet-lagged. Sometimes you have to think practically.
First night, second night, whatever. There is nothing that makes a city better than a one-night stand with a sexy stranger who's got a smoking accent,
TJ says. It's not a bad idea. Orgasms do have a way of making everything feel a bit better. They give you a hazy glow. I wouldn't mind a little glow. Something to take away the missing, to ease the entry into my new country in 1 week. Am I Tindering? I ask. Then I shake my head. That's led nowhere for me. The guys I've met there are too young and immature.
You need a guy who's lived a little, Jojo,
TJ says, like a dating sage. I turn to Emerson. Is he right? She shrugs. He's not wrong type of shrug. I'm not saying a grandpa, but I don't see you with someone who has Snapchat, she says. I laugh. They know me so well. And where does that leave me in this one-night stand pursuit? TJ wiggles a brow.
Go old school and bar it up, he says.
Guess that means I need a killer pickup line, I say. I spend the next week prepping to leave the country, stuffing my days with paperwork and goodbyes. I catch the train to New Haven to grab a quick lunch with my mentor, a curator at the university's art museum. Your mom would be so proud of you, curly-haired Andrea tells me with a warm smile. And I am too. Her words make me feel a little better about getting on the plane. So do TJ's and Emerson's as they feed me pickup lines all week. Then I get on the plane for London, eager to work. But first, one night stand, here I come.
Chapter 3. Heath. I survive 5 days of this mad state of affairs at work. Emily hasn't yet rendered her verdict. Will it be Rhea or Freddy who's my new partner? I worry the delay means she'll assign me both and the joke will be on me. But for the weekend, I'm free. On Friday evening, I escape the office by way of the stairs, avoiding lift chatter and happy hour invites. When I reach the main level, I peer to the left, the right. The coast is clear, so I cruise through the lobby. Once I'm safely on the street, I walk quickly away from the building, heading toward the river as the fog rolls in. Ah, yes. It's everywhere, this beautiful beast. Up the river, down the river, like a smoky gray animal brandishing its claws. I stop when I reach the bridge, where I fish my camera from my pocket and snap a picture. I'll call it Coming to Get You. It seems a good omen, catching that moment, and the weekend coasts on like that, a mix of reading and walking, stories and photos. My friend Griffin sends me a text, asking me if I've ever been to the Apothecary Garden in Chelsea near the Thames, and if he should add it to his tours. I bristle because I have not been there yet. But no is an unacceptable answer, so I immediately make my way over to the Chelsea Physic Garden, which happens to be open that Saturday. I slip through a little gate in the garden wall, then wander the pathways. I record my trek past the flower beds and orchards, snapping photos of plants, and sending him them along with details about the foliage. These are the oldest medicinal gardens in London, home to more than 5,000 plants, which experts have claimed can cure all kinds of malady. Maybe there's a plant here that can cure my woes. But what are they? Loneliness? grumpiness. Or maybe there's no tincture for being malcontent. Later that day, I find Nigel and some of my other mates for a game of chess in the park. It's quiet, barely a word spoken. I beat Nigel and leave the game mostly satisfied. On Sunday evening, I head out of my flat in Covent Garden to meet my younger brother at Sticks and Stones, a nearby bar. He lives in New York, but he's in the homeland for a month, for the world premiere of a new play on the West End, and so it begins. The show is dark on Sundays, so it's our catch-up time. Jude's already at the counter, all sun-streaked blonde hair and soon-to-be-a-movie-star grin, chatting with the bartender. When he spots me, he turns away from her and rises from the stool. "You made it through an entire week of peopling," Jude announces as I stride toward him. "Congratulations!" I make a quieting motion, as if quelling thunderous applause. "Please hold the standing ovation until later. They haven't yet announced a verdict." He cuffs me on the shoulder, then settles back onto his stool. "Ah, well, I simply meant, you're alive." "Miracles do happen," I say. That's what I tell myself every day, as I stare at the phone like a dog waiting for supper, just hoping and praying Davis Milo will call to cast me in his next Oscar-nommed film. I roll my eyes. "Dramatic much." "Dramatic always, I should hope," he says. "And I've no doubt Milo will offer you the lead in his next big film." I do believe that from the bottom of my heart. "From your mouth to God's ears," Jude says. "Also, need I remind you of the film buzz you're getting for If Found, Please Return, and, oh, gee, the play you just opened here?" "You don't have to remind me, but I love it when you do." "I know, Jude, I know." I pat his shoulder. He likes praise, and it's easy to give it to him, so I don't mind. I settle in at the bar, order a gin from the bartender, then turn to my brother again. He gives me an expectant look and a keep-it-rolling gesture. "So, they forced you to work with other people. Was it as horrific as you expected?" I think back on the work week and shudder. Meetings, teamwork sessions, talking. "The thing is," I say, "it's not so much the brainstorming that I object to." Jude tilts his head, curious. "Wait, I thought that was exactly what you objected to." "No, it's all the small talk. Do you have any idea what sort of small talk people make with a widower?" Jude, at the ripe old age of 31, has never been married. He shakes his head. "I have no idea. Why don't you tell me?" he asks earnestly. But grief is no one's favorite subject. It's been 4 years since Violet died, and my heart doesn't ache anymore. I count that as a good thing. Yes, a part of me will probably always miss her, but I've healed. I've moved on because life goes on. Still, I don't want to be a project. "You know how it's been. Everyone's been wanting to set me up since a few months after she died. My co-workers are still determined to do so. Every brainstorming session at work is basically one long prelude to, 'So, would you like to meet Louise? She's a librarian. Can I introduce you to Olivia? She lost her husband to a stroke too. How about Penny? She's dating again after a divorce.'" As the bartender brings my gin, Jude smiles sympathetically. I thank the bartender, then lift my glass. "Cheers." "Cheers," he says, tipping his glass to mine. But he doesn't take a drink. "Is that such a bad thing, though?" I knock back a swallow as I consider his question. I'm not interested in chasing love around. I tried a few of those setups a couple years ago. I was always that widower, that man, that "are you doing okay now" guy. Sympathy is lovely and all, but wrap it up with dating and I felt like a fool. Like I was trying to live someone else's life, seeking out romance after I'd had a big one. At age 40, is that who I should be? A man about town? It doesn't feel like me. I don't know how to be that guy, and I certainly don't want to be that man at work. There, my identity isn't tied to my love life, or lack thereof, and that's how it ought to be. I don't want to mingle my professional and personal lives. Besides, I've grown accustomed to my widower ways, to work and more work, to the salve of keeping busy with books and photos, and planning the best auctions and private sales the London art world has ever seen. That should be enough. Jude's question's a good one, though, and he deserves an answer, especially since he's the only one I discuss all this, well, feelings stuff with. The thought of being dependent on someone else is a little horrifying, I say plainly. I can understand that. That's Jude's specialty. He's deeply empathetic. Great skill being an actor. But you don't have to be dependent. You could just date. Screw the work setups, though. You don't need your colleagues to be your matchmaker. The internet is a fantastic one. You could finally try online dating. That's how a lot of people meet these days. Even people your age. Thanks. Thanks a lot. I mean it, he insists. Yes, that's clear. I sigh heavily. Apps just seem... He picks up the thread. They aren't your style. You're too old-fashioned? Yes. If the shoe fits. But that's not the only reason I haven't downloaded Tinder or Fender or Bubble Winder or what have you. Do I dare to voice it, though? Jude takes a long pull of his beer, sets it down, runs his thumb along the rim. Do you actually want to date again? That's the real question, one I'm not sure I have the answer to. But I know this much. I enjoy companionship of the female variety. Yes, I know. Curves and whatnot are your thing. I place my palms together in prayer. Bless curves. Bless them all night long. I stare at the shelf of liquor behind the bar, my vision going a little blurry, but not from sadness over the past, more from sadness over the future. Does it even hold anything more in the romance realm for me? Or have I used up my allotment of love? Sometimes I wonder if maybe you only have one great love in your life, I say. Would it be so bad if that was all that happened to me? His blue eyes go thoughtful. Do you truly believe that? Then he adopts a devilish look. I mean, I've been in love 50,000 times. I laugh lightly. Yes, I know. But at the moment, I'm avoiding it like I avoid Googling myself. He squeezes my shoulder. You, though, different story. You should at least think about it again. Getting out there. Should I? Dating has changed, or so I imagine. I was 22 when I met Violet. That was 18 years ago. I'm not whining, simply stating facts. The world only turns forward, and I haven't spun the dating wheel in nearly 2 decades. He nods, acknowledging that point. True. But you know what hasn't changed, Heath? What's that? I ask. Though from the way he talks, I'm pretty sure I'm walking right into a verbal trap. He wiggles a brow. Sex. Sex hasn't changed. And you, Heath, you just really sound like you need to get laid. I laugh. He's not far off. I do miss that. A lot. Yes, that would be nice too. Why don't we focus on that? Get you back in action, tonight. Do it, do it, do it. Ending his chant, Jude shoots me a steely stare, the smolder that works on men and women alike when he flashes it on screen or stage. I shake my head, amused at his antics. But of course, I'll just go have a shag right the fuck now. He smacks his palm on the wood of the bar. That's what I'm talking about. Jude glances around, draws a deep breath, studies the scene. All right, I'm devising a plan. Wait, you're serious? Yes, of course I'm serious. He taps his temple. And as I said, I have a plan already. I'm that good, that sharp. Do you know that saying, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar? Of course. Tonight, you're going to be honey, Heath. You're going to laugh. You're going to smile. You're going to be engaging, if you can indeed do that. I know how to be engaging, thank you very much. You do, but you disengage that gear most of the time. So maybe turn that frown upside down, and let's see if we can get you a little something with some honey. You want me to act nice and get laid, I say, part teasing, as if the concept is that hard to get my head around. Yes, who knows? It might improve your mood, which will make work more enjoyable, even that office collaboration bit. Hell, getting laid will make your fucking toast tomorrow more enjoyable. Sex makes literally everything more fun. I arch a brow. Literally everything? Dental appointments? Dreadful meetings that should have been an email? Riding the tube at rush hour? Yes, 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 every single thing, he says, emphatic to the core. Clinical studies have shown that getting laid is directly related to happiness. I doubt there are studies on that topic. He stares down his nose at me. That's exactly the kind of shit scientists love to study. Come to think of it, he's probably not wrong. Nor are the scientists. Sex does boost your mood. Endorphins, orgasms, all that. Maybe I've been overcomplicating this whole dating thing. Perhaps I should have been thinking of it more simply as sex. I like sex. Lots of women like sex, too. What's good for the goose should be good for the gander. For anyone who's having consensual sex, really. To each their own. Besides, it isn't sex I've wanted to avoid, but the setups. Fine, I huff, conceding. He pumps a fist. Yes! Heath is getting laid tonight! You're assuming we'll find somebody who wants to hook up with me. Piece of cake! You're half as good looking as I am, which is plenty to do the trick for you, and I've seen you turn on the charm before. Maybe a century ago, but still. He rubs his palms together. Let's do it! He says it like he's my swim coach and he's about to send me into the deep end. Laughing, I ask, and how would you propose I find this woman for one night? People still meet at bars. He waves a hand grandly to indicate the crowd around us. Sure, there are some ladies here. What's your type? You always like the pretty ones. The pretty ones with brains, I correct. Pretty and witty. Got it. We're going to find someone right here. How about the next clever beauty who walks through the door?